My grandfather and I didn't have a lot in common. He was a practical, problem-solving dairy farmer from right around Revillo, South Dakota, focused solely on getting his chores done and making it through the day. But the one thing we did have was books, a very particular type of book. My grandfather, always a champion for a bargain, would attend farm and estate sales as a hobby of sorts, long after the big ticket and high demand items had been sold, often after most of the crowd had gone home, my grandfather would buy that last box of orphaned books. These books had matured like a fine wine. You could smell them coming from a block away. Most people would describe these books as old or cheap, but to my grandfather and I, they were a treasure. Overfilled with old hard-covered Reader's Digests and long outdated atlases, he'd tow these boxes home and pick through them for himself. But those remaining books that had been filtered by the original owner, their heirs, the other auction attendees, and my grandfather, those remaining books would come to me. I remember reading about the practical etiquette of 1950s party hosting, the proper approach to sheep shearing, a guide to turn-of-the-century penmanship, and a host of other completely unnecessary things. To a younger me, it was paradise. It was in one of those boxes that I would find an old tattered magazine that would introduce me to Abraham Flexner. In the midst of the Great Depression, when Grandma was efficiently reusing week-old cooking grease, Flexner decided that our best and brightest minds should actually be less productive. In the tradition of Galileo and Newton, he argued for the cultivation of curiosity, and in the process became my patron saint. But I'm getting ahead of myself. Hi, I'm Hugh Weber, and I'm excited to welcome you to the Potluck Society. In October of 1939, Abraham Flexner wrote a provocative piece for Harper's titled The Usefulness of Useless Knowledge. Flexner was attempting to build a space for leading scientists, mathematicians, and historians of the time to focus on the pursuit of knowledge as its own benefit. He argued that practicality and pragmatism leave very little room for curiosity and discovery. In the article, Flexner writes, "Curiosity, which may or may not eventuate in something useful, is probably the outstanding characteristic of modern thinking. I like to imagine Albert Einstein and his very, very brainy colleagues in what the New York Times would describe as a scholar's paradise, focused on the bits and pieces of knowledge."
Bits and pieces, odds and sods. We have lots of different slang terms for just the ordinary things that are going on around you. So it's just the small, unnoticed, out of eyesight pieces that I think are worthwhile pursuing.
I'm sorry, that's not Abraham Flexner or Albert Einstein. That is James Jennings, the insanely curious young man who I'm pleased to introduce you to today. Please welcome James Jennings.
My name's James Jennings. I'm originally from Somerset in England, and I'm now studying classics and philosophy at Augustana University in Sioux Falls, South Dakota.
The son of a very practical engineer and accountant, James found his way to South Dakota as a business and economics student. That changed when he took a distinctly British idea to Augustana University professor of philosophy, David O'Hara.
During my junior year, I liked the idea. I was talking to David O'Hara about this and brought up the idea of having a tea drinking society, somewhere where it was just a conversation group and you'd meet up maybe once, twice a month and talk about topics of interest to you.
But Professor O'Hara had a different idea.
Dave put forward the idea of a group called the Society for the Preservation of Unnecessary Knowledge, which we lovingly refer to as SPUNK.
They quickly wrote a SPUNK constitution, were formally recognized as a university club, and got busy with the work of preserving unnecessary knowledge. The nuances of flag design, the rules of cricket, and the strategy of solving Rubik's Cubes.
And so we've met on all different kinds of bits and pieces, and it's still just a nice chance for different members of the community at Augustana to come together and talk about little bits of knowledge, packets of information that they know a great deal about and that they want to share with other people.
From a practical point of view, intellectual life is on the surface a useless form of activity in which men indulge because they procure for themselves greater satisfactions than are otherwise obtainable. That's Abraham Flexner. Here's James again.
Spunk is a conversation, and that's one of the things I'm very happy it is. It's simply a chance to meet new people, to talk about things that interest you. We mildly pretentiously consider it to be part of like a French salon or those kind of ideas where intellectuals would get together and they would discuss the ideas of the day.
And this is where we begin to see the hints of the useful among the useless and unnecessary.
I think my favorite discussion we've started was on cartography and paper towns.
That's right. He said paper towns. Now, if you're not familiar, listen closely here.
There's this almost an imaginary place called Agglo, New York, which was put on a map during the 1930s, I believe, if I'm remembering correctly.
He is.
And it was just a combination of the writers of the map. They wanted a copyright trap, so that's what a paper town is. It's to make sure that no one just takes your map and passes it off as their own, because my map is going to look very similar to your map, because we're trying to map the same part of the world, and it should, in a sense, be identical. So Agglo, New York was created to catch people out that use their map.
So just let me summarize. Map makers, to avoid being copied, put fake towns on their maps. Agglo, New York was just a fake town on the map. End of story.
But in being put on a map at the crossroads of two tiny dirt roads, Agglo, New York became a real place.
It was like Agglo, New York had been willed into existence. At one point, it had a gas station, a village shop, and even 50 people who lived there.
I think it's a wonderful story, and it's a wonderful thing to discuss about how the things we write about and the things we imagine to exist can actually come into reality. And so it's this beautiful metaphor, but in the end, Agglo, New York was simply an idea, but it became something much more real.
Throughout the whole history of science, most of the really great discoveries, which have ultimately proven to be beneficial to mankind, have been made by men and women who were driven not by the desire to be useful, but merely the desire to satisfy their curiosity. That's Abraham Flexner again. But I can't help but believe that James and his fellow members of Spunk would agree wholeheartedly.
Thank you, James.
Thank you.
The thing I found about this idea of unnecessary and useless knowledge is that the second you bring it up, everyone has something to share. I learned over the past couple weeks about the origins of the Heath Bar, which we'll definitely discuss on a future program. But some people shared wisdom on weaponry or told me about the neurological stress response of assaulted mice, which was all a bit overwhelming. More than that, it became clear that one person could help put all of this into perspective. So I called my friend Altman Studeni. Altman is an artist and city council member from Plankinton, South Dakota.
Where I'd just love to start is just to talk a little bit about your work and practice as an artist and as a, you know, depending on how you frame it, as a community builder and maker and creator. Maybe share a little bit of that background, Altman.
Sure. Can I ask you, are we recording now? Should I get up to the...
We never stop recording.
Okay, should I get up to the microphone?
I was actually asked if I was just going to start wearing a wire, and I think I might.
Yeah, that's not a bad idea.
Because I don't want to miss one moment. I don't want to miss a thing.
That's right. I told you about Tony Schwartz for WNYC, who invented a little sleeve microphone that he clipped to his jacket with a wire that ran up through his coat to a reel-to-reel that he carried around in a suitcase, so that he'd be able to like get everything from his postal code. He just walked around the city all day long, kind of getting jump rope rhymes and tons of taxi cab drivers talking about what their beat was and stuff. So
it's the dream, right?
Yeah, it's pretty good, right? Nothing lost. So I'm sorry, what was the question?
I'm going to be upfront right from the beginning. I adore Altman Studeni, but these tangents, these loose ends, these winding paths of conversation are a critical element in the way we talk with each other. This went on for another 20 minutes, but ultimately we got back to the focus on unnecessary and useless knowledge and the stories that serve as the past and future of our communities. Listen in.
Tell me about what those stories are in Plankinton, in the community you both represent and reside. Tell me what those stories look like that are maybe from an outside perspective or even for someone living there are somewhat useless or extraneous, but you think are those vital threads.
Right. Well, like coming back from Maine, where I went to grad school,
I was really interested in reinvesting in those stories. So I revisited a lot of stuff that I remember hearing when I was a kid. You know, one of them that's like my favorite is my grandmother, who used to be the editor of the newspaper in Plankinton, when she was young, lived through like the 30s, and told a great story of her cousin sleeping in a bassinet on the front porch when a locust storm came through, like a cloud of grasshoppers. And in the rush to like get the laundry off the line and, you know, protect whatever garden they were able to protect, forgot that the baby was in the porch, and the locust swarm chewed off his hair, with the exception of like a little piece on the back where his head was against the pillow. And now that isn't a major mythological story, right? Like when you the story of the town isn't told in that, if you would like open up the Aurora County history book. But that is such an indicator of place. Like that type of story is one that conceals a lot of the feeling of a community or the feeling of what a community's been through. And to have that be something that wasn't big news, like that's not a front page news story, but something that would be buried in the locals. I love that sense of it being sort of secret or sort of like a non-event, you know, that just happened, and that's not, you know, that's, and things like that happen all the time.
Now, just so I'm contextualizing this, which I'm not sure is entirely necessary, Flexner is at Princeton telling Einstein to relax, and Altman's ancestors are being attacked by locusts. Back to the conversation.
How do you go about making sure that that doesn't live with you, like, or isn't lost with you? And if it is lost, because you've told me many stories over time around the campfire. I've heard many Altman stories, never heard that one. What's lost if it's not shared? What's lost if that isn't preserved? And how might we work around that being lost?
Yeah, that's a really good question, and I'm kind of at a weird place with that right now. I'm trying to kind of find a suitable conclusion that like honors that story, without turning that story into something that's kind of precious or hokey. You know, something that I'm kind of holding on to, and I'm just field testing this aloud right now, so I don't know if it's going to hold. But that whether or not that story is actually passed along, like whether the words of that story are written down for, you know, fourth graders learning South Dakota history to read, those fourth graders are in some way keeping that story in themselves. Because if my grandmother had that experience, then their great-grandmothers would have had that experience. And in the way that they were raised by their parents, and their parents were raised by their parents, and down the line, like each of us contains some version of that story, whether the details are exact or not.
Do you see what he said there? The stories that weren't even useful at the time, beyond maybe for idle chit-chat or to fill the time that we now fill with Facebook, form our current reality. They are the undercurrent of who we are and ultimately who we will be.
The big one that I think about a lot in terms of Plankinton is the story of the Grain Palace. And this is one that I know that I've told you before. But at the end of Main Street in 1891, the business leaders or the community leaders of Plankinton decided that they were going to follow the model of Sioux City, Iowa, and erect a grain palace to show off the bounty of Dakota Territory.
Altman loves this story. He loves it so much that he shared it in full on stage at Oda Bismarck in early 2016. Let's listen to that version.
So in 1891, at the north end of Main Street, in my hometown of Plankinton, South Dakota, a group of local businessmen and citizen volunteers erected a structure that was to showcase the bounty of Aurora County land to the rest of America far and wide. Room for 5 million, they said, of the region's potential. 100,000 immigrants per year at least. The project they were enacting was to pick up where Sioux City's Grain Palace, the first of its kind in the nation, left off and would be the first of its kind in the new state of South Dakota.
In the commemorative edition of the Aurora County Standard newspaper, which would later become the South Dakota Mail, and would even later than that become my family's business for four generations, a column was printed entitled, "The State Feels Proud as a Turkey Cock Over the Agricultural Outlook of 1892. She is this season the bright particular star in the agricultural firmament," and I'm quoting the author here, "the sparkler whose brilliancy makes every other star pale and wan and diminished in luster, the only one which can rank of the first magnitude. She comes out from behind the clouds which at one time or another have obscured every other star and now beams her attractions throughout the sky. It will need no almanac nor astronomical chart to locate South Dakota hereafter. She'll stick out so luminously prominent that no man can turn his gaze upward or outward without seeing her. And now let every resident turn astrologer and induce the people of the East and the West and the North and the South to accept the opportunity to get directly under the denigant influence of this luck winner, this star of the empire. It shines for all. Under its rays, the home seekers of a whole continent may come. Say to them, as Emerson said, hitch your wagon to the star. And while you're hitching, pick out the dandiest blazer in the firmament, Sigma Delta in the new Northwestern constellation." Now, if one were to have been a guest of the Plankton Grain Palace that autumn of 1891, and between the shocks of wheat, and the marching band acts, and the taxidermy displays of local fauna, glanced out from the second-story landing, one would have looked upon a scene very similar to this one. All of that grand eloquence, all of that language was for this, mile after mile of rolling grassland. The dandiest blazer in the firmament. But all that empty space. But you know, and I know, and I believe that you and I both do our best to share with others the truth, that the spaces that we look out upon are not empty. They are in fact filled with inspiration, with potential, with room for one more mind working in its own way to assure that the future of this region is one where there is always room for one more mind cracking the riddle of what it just can't get around, what it loves.
And now back to our conversation.
And to see what was in place around that building at the time that they were writing that is just an idea. There was nothing else there. There was nothing else at the end of Main Street. It was just miles and miles of prairie. And that story of, you know, being able to see the potential in a place is certainly one that needs to be at the forefront of our minds and played out again and again, and us be conscious of that being played out right now too, that we have an opportunity presently to see the potential in a place by using what's around us.
And to think and create and to urge it into being.
Right.
Just like Agglo, New York.
I like if we're talking about kind of useless information, I mean, I like in my own practice to think about how the way that we make and do things in South Dakota or the Midwest or the Upper Plains or whatever we want to call this region is artful. Like, it's not what separates the way that we live our lives and a contemporary art project is very thin. You know, it's just the umbrella of art. Like, one functions under this particular history and these particular terms that we use to define it, and the other doesn't. And I love bringing in those sort of antiquated or archaic or backwards ways of processing the world and making things, bringing those into the conversation about art. So, like, when I got really fascinated with Jell-O, that was a studio practice, like, to think about what someone's grandmother was doing as having enough work and enough attention and enough materials knowledge inherent in it that it could be equal to the painting practice that I was having at the time. I got disinterested in paint. I really liked the thought of making Jell-O as an art project.
Altman's downplaying his love for Jell-O, and we're going to revisit that at some point in the future. But whether you find wisdom comes from grain palaces or Jell-O molds, I think it's clear that there's something useful to be found in the useless knowledge. Many radio programs and podcasts try to tell clear, linear stories with tidy conclusions. We're not going to do that. The Potluck Society is going to be a bit more DIY. Messy, but meaningful. And I know you'll enjoy. Each week, in addition to people, places, and ideas we visit, I'm going to ask you to take an action. These will be small, quick acts of curiosity, creativity, and community that should cost you little or nothing, but will be sort of an antidote to the apathy and indifference of the world. This week, I want you to go to Bill Murray's Wikipedia page. That's right. Wikipedia is a modern cabinet of curiosities if you allow yourself to explore a bit. So open up a browser and go to Bill Murray's Wikipedia page. Now, I want you just to wander a bit and click three page lengths deep. Let me show you. I'm going to click on Mark Twain Prize for American Humor. Okay. I'm going to click on Richard Pryor. And this tells me that Seinfeld once called Richard Pryor the Picasso of the profession. And why not? I'll click Picasso. Okay, somewhere entirely different than when I started, but I find out that Picasso painted mostly from imagination or memory. I find that fascinating. So what's the action? I want you to capture a screenshot of the page you end up on your phone or computer, and post it somewhere. I don't care if it's Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, just get it out in the world and use the hashtag PS001 so we know you did it. That's it. You did it. Thanks this week to everyone that helped get this thing off the ground. James Jennings, Altman Studeni, and Abraham Flexner, thank you for the inspiration. Carl Koiser with the editing, Mike Yeager and Chad Conrad with musical support, Kara Hetlin and Laurie Walsh at South Dakota Public Broadcasting, who have taught me radio over the past month, and to the letters A, E, and F, thanks for all you do. I hope I'll see you soon here at the Potluck Society. And as always, don't forget to bring an idea to pass.